Shalom, welcome to the Jewish Task Force, JTF. My name is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to a refuah shlema, complete recovery, for David Raphael Ben Fanya, Sharon Katz, Shlomo Ben Avraham, and Dorit Bat Sara, and to elevating the souls of Hadassa Bat Yitzchak, Simcha Bat Rachel, Pesach Zeev Ben Chava, Harab Mir Kahana, Yosef Ben Meir, Bari Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Robert Mittman, and Sipora Fegi Bat Liba. We have two subjects we want to discuss on this week's program. The first subject is the Jewish view of Satan. In the Christian religion, they refer to him as the devil. And there's a certain Jewish view, which is very different from the Christian and Muslim view. The Christian and Muslim view is actually similar in that the Christians and the Muslims believe that there's an evil being called Satan. And the Jewish view is rather unique. We also want to discuss as our second subject, what did American Jews do during the Holocaust when 6 million Jews were being murdered? Did they know? Of course they knew. They knew what was going on and how American Jews betrayed the 6 million. They could have stopped the Holocaust. They could have saved millions of Jewish lives. But they didn't do so. And that is an eternal shame and an eternal crime that unfortunately is part of American Jewish history. And we're going to discuss it on this program. But first, let's talk about Satan. Christianity adopted the dualistic view of Satan. What does that mean? There was a view, the Zoroastrian view, and some of the pagan religions believed that there's a good God and a bad God. That there's a God that only does good and there's a God that is evil. And there's a great conflict in the world between the good God and the evil God. That's dualism. It's called dualism. And it's part of the Zoroastrian religion of ancient times. Christianity adopted that to a great degree in their view of Satan. They claim that Satan was a fallen angel and that he and other angels rebelled and that they're in rebellion and they're fighting against God, which means that angels have the power to resist God and fight against God and do things against God, or God allows angels to rebel and do evil things. Whatever your view is, this is a view that is very different from the Jewish view. The Muslim view is also similar to the Christian view in that they also believe that Satan is a being that acts independently of God and is actually rebelling against God and fighting against God and fighting against God's wishes. Because the Christian and Muslim view is that God himself cannot allow or would not do certain things that they deem as bad. God can only be good. He can't possibly do bad things. And so there has to be a separate being that exists that does the bad things. And of course, the Christians don't have that much of a problem with that departure from the Torah monotheistic view of the world. The Torah view of the world is that God controls everything. God controls everything. He does give human beings free will. He gives human beings the ability to make choices between good and evil. But he does not do that in the spiritual world. He does not do that with his angels. In any event, what is the Jewish view of Satan? Hasatan, as we see in the book of Iov in the Bible, Hasatan is an angel and part of the many angels that God created in the spiritual world. And he only does what God tells him to do and only does what God allows him to do. Satan is a servant of God. And he carries out God's wishes and God's orders fully. He has no free will. And the other angels have no free will. In the Jewish view, only human beings have free will. Only human beings have what we refer to in Hebrew as bechira chofshit, which means free will. They can choose between good and evil. And the whole story of the Torah is the struggle between good and evil and the choices that people have to make and the end consequences of those choices. But the angels in the angelic world and in the spiritual world, once you leave the physical world and once God's presence is apparent, There no longer is any free will. Everybody does what God commands, and everybody only wants to do what God commands, and everybody wants to get as close to God and be as loyal to God as possible. And so we see Satan in the Jewish world as a figure who tempts people to do evil. And he's also a figure who gives people free will, because he's also Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is the evil inclination. So human beings have a Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination, and they have a Yetzer Hatov, a good inclination. They have, within our nature, we have two forces that are always fighting and battling for control of our decisions and for control of our view of the world. We have the good inclination and the evil inclination. The good inclination comes from our soul. Our soul is pure, and our soul wants to do what God would want us to do. But our body tells us to do something else. And there's this constant battle. And because the world, because God seemingly is absent from the world, we have the free will to do evil if we wish. And most people choose to do evil, unfortunately. In fact, in Hebrew, the Hebrew term for world is olam. Olam is how you say world in Hebrew. And it comes from the word ne'elam, which means to be absent. Because God is seemingly absent in this world. His presence seemingly is not here in this world. You can go through all of life and never believe in God, and just believe in the forces of nature, and just believe that God doesn't exist. You can go through all of life like that, easily. Because God deliberately created a situation where he is seemingly absent in this world. Why? Because if God was openly present in the world, if God openly made his presence known and his existence known in the world, we wouldn't have free will anymore. We would be terrified to do wrong. Even evil people would be terrified to do wrong, because of the consequences of reward and punishment. And so in order to give people true free will, part of our test in this world, part of our nisayon, part of our test in this world, is the test, do we believe in God? Do we decide to do good? Do we decide to follow our good instincts? Or do we do the selfish, egotistical, evil thing, and go with and live for the moment instead of living in the long term and seeing the long term picture? But Hasatan, Satan, he is the evil inclination in us. He is what makes us want to sin. He's what tells us, oh, don't worry about it. God is merciful. He'll forgive you. You can sin. You can get away with it. Or he's the one who tells us, how do you know there is a God? Did you ever meet him? Did you ever see him? He's the one who makes us doubt. He's the one who challenges our faith. He's the one who makes us want to believe in evil things. And of course, we have all of our physical urges. We call them ta'avot in Hebrew. All of our physical urges to do bad things, to eat unhealthy food and unkosher food, to commit sexual immorality, to engage in other practices which are forbidden, which would be forbidden by the Torah. All of these things are part of our test, are part of our challenge. Because God does not want a situation where he gives us the tremendous, unbelievable, unimaginable reward of eternal life in a paradise way beyond anything we can imagine. He doesn't want to give us this for nothing. In other words, we didn't do anything to earn it. All of a sudden, we're given this. If you were suddenly given by somebody millions of dollars, and all of a sudden you get all of these things without earning anything, just for no reason, somebody just decides to give you all of this for nothing. You don't work for it, you don't earn, you don't do anything. You just hand it everything, all for nothing. You get everything for nothing. You're going to wind up feeling guilty. You're going to wind up feeling, hey, wait a minute, I didn't do anything to earn this. You're not going to enjoy those things as much as you would if you yourself had earned it. And the same is true in the next world. We have built within us a desire to earn whatever we achieve, to earn whatever reward God gives us. We want to be able to go to the next world and have good deeds so that we could say to ourselves, when God gives us good things, God willing, that we did in fact do things that got us to this place, that earned us this. And so when you do things for other people, selfless things, to make this a better world, and sacrifice to make this a better world, and follow God's commandments, and live a moral life and a good life, and believe in God with all your heart and soul, when you do those things, there is a reward at the end. There is a reward. We're promised a reward at the end. Now, Satan, what is Satan's role? Satan's role is to say, come on. First of all, his role is to say, how do you know there's really a reward? How do you know there's really a God? How do you know there's a world to come? How do you know there's a spiritual world? How do you, you know, challenging your faith. That's the first thing. And we're required to believe. We're required to believe. It's very important that we believe with perfect faith in the existence of God, in the existence of the next world, in Judaism, in the Torah. And I'm referring to Jews here. Gentiles are not required to believe in Judaism. Gentiles get a pass on a lot of things that Jews must believe in. For Jews, it's much stricter because they're expected to know, because they're part of the chosen people and they're part of a special people that is required to believe and is required to be a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests. That's the role of the Jews in this world. And when they don't live up to that role, the punishment is severe. And when they do live up to it, the reward is tremendous. So we're required to believe these things. And Satan is what God created an angel, Satan, so that we would be tempted not to do that, not to do the good things. And sometimes we make excuses about God's existence. We even if we deep down do believe, we make excuses because we don't want there to be a God to tell us what to do, to tell us what we can eat and what we can wear and where we can go and what we can say and what we have to do with our money and what we have to do with our lives and how we have to devote our time and how we have to say our prayers and so on and so forth. Yeah, there are people don't want that. There are people that don't want to be part of that. And that's also, God puts that, that's built into our personality. That's part of our challenge. We have to overcome the fact that our personalities as human beings are laziness. The natural inclination of somebody is just to lie back and do nothing. Just to do nothing. If God didn't give us the requirement that we have to eat, why did God make it that we have to eat? Why do we have to eat food? You know, he could have just created people and they don't have to eat anything. They just have to breathe air and that's enough and they can live with just breathing air. Because God wanted us to have to get up and go out and work so that we can put food in our stomachs and so that we could feed our families. So God created food. The reason we have food and the reason we have to eat to survive is so that we'll go out and do something, so that we'll take the initiative, so that we won't just sit back and lay back and do nothing, which is the natural inclination for human beings. If they don't have a challenge, if there's no reason for them to get up and do things, their natural inclination is going to be laziness. And God takes that away from us. He makes us want to go out, and then he gives us an ego, which makes us want to work, and makes us want to acquire things, which we can use for good or we can use for bad. When we acquire possessions and acquire money and acquire things, we can use that to make this a better world. Of course, we have to have a roof over our heads and we have to pay our bills and we have to survive, but we also have to be concerned about making this a better world. And God gives us that challenge. But he makes us want to go out and do things. He gives us the will to go out and do things and be willing to sacrifice and be willing to do a lot in order to achieve our goals. Think of how much people are willing to sacrifice just to make money. How hard people are willing to work. Can you imagine if they were willing to do just 1% of that for their fellow Jews? If Jews were willing to do just 1% for their fellow Jews as they're willing to do for their own bank accounts and for their own lives. Can you imagine how much better the world would be? And of course you have to do a lot more than just 1%. You have to do a lot more than that. But God creates this challenge for us. And in the end, what God is going to say to those who were selfish and those who didn't care and those who didn't do what they were supposed to do, God's going to say, why should I have mercy on you? Did you have mercy on your fellow Jews in Israel who were being murdered, who were in danger, who were trying to settle in the land of Israel, who were doing the right thing? Did you care about creating eternal redemption for all generations? Did you care about something more important than yourself? Or you're only concerned about how big your car is and how big your house is and how great your investments are, or the football game and baseball game and sports that people devote their lives and their lives revolve around the ball, who hits the ball or who kicks a ball, and that's what their lives revolve around. Which black football player kicked the ball or put a basketball through the hoop. I mean, this is, people's lives revolve around these ridiculous things. And it is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It's laughable when you think about it. It's worse than childish. It's so pathetic. What in the world is that going to accomplish for you, being concerned about something like that? What in the world good does that do for humanity? But these types of escapes in life, that's also part of the evil inclination. That's also part of Yetzer Hara. And so Satan is there to tempt. He's God's angel. He does what God says. He's not some independent evil force with a tail and with a horns. He's God's angel who is there to give you free will, to make sure you have free will, to make sure that every step you take in life, you're challenged and you have free will. If you do the right thing, the reward is tremendous. You will never in the end, maybe not in this world sometimes maybe not until the next world, but in the end, you will never regret doing the right thing. You will never regret it in the long run. It is always worth it to do the right thing. It is always worth it to make the right choice. Always. Always. God will always make it worth it in the end, one way or another. If not in this world, then in the next. It will always be worth it. In the end, you will always be happy that you made the right choice in the long run. And you will always regret in the end if you made the wrong choice, one way or another. Even if you get a temporary gain sometimes in this world, and you say, oh, I'm glad I did that. Wow, I got ahead by doing that. If you did something wrong, and you think you got ahead, or you think you got something that you like, in the end, you're going to regret it. In the end, you're going to realize you made the wrong choice, and it was a mistake. It was a bad move. Always in the end. It is never worth defying God. It is never worth going against God. And so, we have a world of challenges. And, you know, in the Islamic world, you have the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Sunnis are about 90% of the Muslims in the world. The Shiites are about 10%. The Sunnis believe that Allah, God, their name for God in Arabic, that He decides everything, that they don't have free will. The Sunnis don't believe in free will. They believe Allah decides everything. They believe you're limiting God by saying there's free will. Wah! You mean you have free will to go against God? That's like limiting God. That's an insult to God. But the absurdity of Islam is that here you have a situation where people then it says in the Quran that people go to hell and are punished and are burning and all types of terrible, terrible punishments described in the Quran. The Quran is a violent, vengeful book full of horrible punishments and horrible things, horrible nightmarish characterizations of this world and of the next. Why do you punish somebody if they didn't have free will in the first place? They weren't guilty. They were forced to do it. According to the Quran, it's all predestined. Everything you do is predestined. Your decisions have already been made for you. You think you're making a decision, but you're not. Allah already made the decision for you. That's the Sunni Muslim belief, which is 90% of the Muslims. And there are Christian sects that also believe in that, of course. And there are other Christian sects that don't. But in Judaism, that's just not the way it works. In Judaism, you make your own decisions and you decide your own fate. And that's true for the Jews and for the Gentiles. The Jews are judged more strictly and have more mitzvot, have more commandments. But the Jew and the Gentile both have free will and both make their own decisions and both have a chance to get into have eternal life and paradise. And it all depends on the decisions you make and on the choices you make in life. We'll discuss this hopefully more in future programs, because we want to do as much discussion on Torah Judaism as possible. But I just wanted to give you a little insight into the Torah Jewish view of the way things work. I'll just give you one last example of why it's worth it doing the good and not the bad. Here's something that's for your good inclination that should make you with your mind decide, I want to do good. If you do something wrong, whether it's gambling or an immoral sexual act or stinginess when there was a reason not to be stingy, when there was a good cause, or eating something you shouldn't have eaten, or over drinking, or all the things that people do, something selfish that you do, or saying bad, backstabbing somebody, all the terrible things that people can do in this world. If you do something evil, right, and you feel you got some satisfaction out of it, that satisfaction is temporary. It won't help you. Let's say, for instance, you get drunk and you enjoy getting drunk. You're not going to get pleasure. The next day, you're not going to have pleasure out of saying, you know, yesterday I got drunk and I really enjoyed getting drunk. You got to get drunk again to enjoy that. What the drunk, your drunkenness yesterday and the buzz you got out of it yesterday, that's not going to do you any good now. That's why you have a lot of alcoholics. Or if you take drugs, the drug you smoked or injected into your body, if you're crazy enough to do those things, or took a pill or whatever crazy things you might do, the horrible drug that you put in your body, the high you got yesterday, that doesn't do you any good now. You can't say, oh, you know, I'm so happy I had that high yesterday. Now I'm satisfied. I can go through the day just happy knowing I was high yesterday. No, you got to get high again. You got to get it again and again and again to satisfy yourself. If you eat something that's unhealthy for you or that's bad for you, you can't say, you know, I really enjoyed that meal yesterday and I enjoyed it so much that I'm having that same pleasure now just thinking about the meal. No, you won't have the same pleasure thinking about it. You're going to want to eat it again. In other words, once you finish the deed that you shouldn't have done, the bad deed, the pleasure is over. Because bad deeds lead not only to temporary pleasure, they lead to a temporary life. Your life will end. It's temporary when you do wrong things. Your life will be temporary, and your pleasure will be temporary, and your deeds will lead to temporary things and to dead ends in life. But when you do something good, let's say you help somebody that you love and care about, your child, son or daughter, or brother or sister, mother or father, you help someone in your family that you love, or you do something good for society, or you do something good for Israel. When you do that and you know you did something good and you know because of you, good was done. You know because of you, something good was done. That's not temporary. You can look back and say, you know, I did that last month and I feel so good that I did that. I feel so good that I helped free Soviet Jews. I feel so good that I helped my father or my mother or my son or my daughter. I feel so good about that. I feel so good about the good things I've done. When you do something good, that satisfaction lives on even after the deed is over. Because good deeds lead to eternal life and eternal satisfaction. The joy and pleasure of the deed does not end when the deed is over, if it's a good deed, if it's the right thing to do. But if it's the wrong thing to do, the joy and pleasure ends right there, right then and there when the deed ends. Not something to think about next time you have a decision to make. Let's move on to the Holocaust, because we have Rosh Hashanah, the new year, coming up and all the high holidays coming up, and it's a time when we're supposed to be introspective and we're supposed to be considering the good things and the wrong things that we've done, and we have to, as Jews, have to consider the good and wrong we've done as a people. American Jews, there were 5 million American Jews during the Holocaust, and they were very powerful. Almost all of Hollywood was controlled and run by Jews. The Jews really did control and run Hollywood. That's not an anti-Semitic exaggeration. That's true. The Jews, all those wonderful, powerful, great moving movies that you saw in the 30s and 40s and 50s, the great movies, 90% of them were done by Jews. The Jews controlled Hollywood. The Jews controlled enough of the news media to make a tremendous difference. The most important newspaper in the world by far was the New York Nazi Times, owned by a self-hating, evil Jewish family, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, the Sulzberger family, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. May their names and memories be obliterated. And Jewish power and influence in the journalistic world, in the media, in the world of art, in the world of science, in the world of business, tremendous power and influence. The governor of New York, Herbert Lehman, was a Jew during the Holocaust. The mayor of New York, Fiorella LaGuardia, the mayor of New York City, Fiorella LaGuardia, was a Jew. Yes, Fiorella LaGuardia's mother was Jewish. His father was Italian, but his mother was Jewish, even though he went around telling most people that he was Italian, because he was also a self-hating Jew. But in any event, Jews had tremendous power and had the power to influence what was going on. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, Shem Reshaim Yirkav, could have stopped the Holocaust dead in its tracks at any time. Because, especially in the beginning of the war, the Germans offered to let the Jews just all leave Europe. They offered to even help the Jews leave Europe. They wanted the Jews out of the way because they wanted, at first, the German Nazi goal was to win the war. They thought they were going to win the war. They thought they were going to conquer the world. They believed their own crazy propaganda that they're the master race and they're going to conquer the world. They believed it. Now, it's true that the most important thing in their agenda was to exterminate the Jewish people. That was their number one thing that they were concerned about. You see their obsession with exterminating Jews. But their strategy was first to win the war, conquer Europe, and then conquer the world afterwards, and then exterminate the Jews wherever they were and anywhere else in the world. But first, they wanted to win the war. So first, they wanted to get all these millions of Jews out of the way. They didn't want that distracting from the war effort. And so they were willing to just move the Jews out of Europe. They were willing to do it. They offered to do it. Over and over again, they offered to do it. And in fact, there were offers even toward the end of the war about selling, about letting a million Jews leave and be saved in exchange for trucks and soap. The Brandt deal that fell through and other things. I mean, the Germans, their number one goal was either to win the war or do what was best for Germany at the time. When they saw that no one in the world wanted the Jews, when they saw that everywhere the Jews went, they were thrown out and they were rejected, then they decided, well, look, they're staying in Europe anyway. We can't have them here. We want to eliminate them, so we're going to have to physically exterminate them. That's when the decision was made. They made the decision that they're going to physically exterminate the Jews at that point. And then the Holocaust decision came through, and they started with the Holocaust. But we had a golden opportunity, for instance, to create a Jewish state. The British did not allow the Jews to go to Israel. And the United States supported that decision. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the anti-Semite, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, supported the British decision to keep the Jews out of Israel. Churchill and Roosevelt locked the doors of the land of Israel to the Jews who could have escaped the Nazi Holocaust and ensured that they would be exterminated. And American Jews did nothing about it. American Jews had such power, they easily could have changed the dynamics of all of that. Easily, with their power. Easily. American Jews turned this country upside down on behalf of blacks in the civil rights movement, turned this country upside down with their protests against the Vietnam War, turned this country upside down over and over again with a million different issues. But for their fellow Jews in Europe, nothing. Except for one organization that existed. The JTF of the Holocaust was an organization put together by Peter Bergson and Ben Hecht, the Hollywood playwright who was responsible for movies like Gone with the Wind, the big Hollywood playwright, a Jewish playwright. And he was helping with an organization that Peter Bergson and other Jabotinsky followers, who were Jewish dissidents, put together to try to save the Jews during the Holocaust. In the end, they saved 500,000 Jews. They saved 500,000 Jews. They were responsible for the Raoul Wallenberg mission that saved Jews in Hungary, and 500,000 Jews were saved because of the efforts of that organization in the end. Anything that was done, the little that was done by American Jews was done by that one organization. No one else lifted a finger. No one else. All the Jewish organizations, B'nai B'rith, the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, Hadassah, the United Jewish Appeal, Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, all the other organizations, not only did nothing to save the 6 million Jews, but sabotaged the efforts of this one organization that was trying to rescue the Jews, sabotaged any rescue efforts. Sabotaged it. Because why? Because they were so concerned that if the Jews were saved, they didn't want the Jews to be saved. These self-hating scum Jewish traitors didn't want the Jews to be saved, because if the Jews were saved, then the Goyim would say that we went into World War II. That we went into World War II just to save the Jews and would cause anti-Semitism, they thought. That was what they were worried about. They're worried about what anti-Semites are going to say while millions of Jews are being burned and gassed, and they're just worried about how they're, about what their neighbors in the country club is, are going to say. I mean, you can't get more evil than that. But that was the American Jewish leaders. That was American Jewry's leadership. You know, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, who refused to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz that would have stopped the transport of Jews to the death camps, and refused to bomb and destroy the death camps themselves, and refused to do many other things that could have stopped the Holocaust dead in its tracks. The German murder machinery could have been stopped dead in its tracks. They bombed a factory 1 mile away from Auschwitz. I mean, American air power, because of Jewish scientists and Jewish brains, they gave America the technology to have complete domination over the skies of Europe in the end. They defeated the German Air Force, and America had mastery over the skies. American and British Air Force had mastery over the skies of Europe. They could have absolutely destroyed the German war machinery. They could have crippled what the Germans were doing with the Jews. And you know, the Germans tested everything they did when they were murdering the Jews. They tested it. Kristallnacht, when they attacked the Jews, that was a test to see how the world would react. Everything they did, they tested first. They were concerned about the reaction of the world. They were concerned about eventual Nazi war crime trials. They were concerned about all of that. And Roosevelt deliberately did everything he could to enable them to carry out the Holocaust. In fact, every road in Europe in Germany was bombed and destroyed to prevent the Germans from conducting their war. The Allies, the American and British air forces, destroyed every road in Germany, every road in Europe that the Nazis were using, except for one road. One road was untouched. The roads that were used to lead the Jews to the death camps, they deliberately left untouched, because they wanted the Jews to be murdered. And American Jews did nothing. American Jews did nothing while this was happening. If this had been blacks in the South, or had been some other cause, especially if it was anti-Semites, if it was some anti-Semitic group, the Jews would have been screaming. They would have turned the whole world upside down. All the Jews in Hollywood, and all the Jews in the media, and all the rich Jews, and all the other, they would all have been screaming and yelling. It would have been the number one issue in America. And the president would not have been able to ignore it. He would have been forced to do something. And the Holocaust would have been stopped. And the Jews would have been rescued, and they would have all gone to Israel. And you would have had 6 million more Jews in Israel. And they were having a lot of, and the 6 million Jews had a high birth rate. So you would have had, today you would have like 20, you'd have like 20 or 30 million Jews living in Israel today. Can you imagine? But American Jews didn't want any part of that. They refused to help Ben Hecht. They voted enthusiastically for Roosevelt, who was deliberately helping to murder the Jews. By the way, there were quotas on how many Jews could come into the United States. To show you how anti-Semitic the Roosevelt administration was, they didn't even fulfill their quotas from Germany, Poland, and these other countries. In other words, there were quotas of how many could come in, and they left, the vast majority of the quotas were left unfilled. The Jews could have come in, many Jews could have come in and been saved under the quotas, but they left those quotas unfilled. They were closing the doors to Jews, even though under their own quotas, the Jews were eligible to come in under those circumstances. Eventually, the War Refugee Board was created by Congress, and again, 500,000 Jews were saved, but that was all Peter Bergson and Ben Hecht and this one group of Jewish activists who were like the JTF of those days, speaking out and doing, or the JDL of those days. And so the horrible history of American Jewry is an eternal stain on American Jewry and on the Jewish people as a whole. Terrible betrayal. By the way, the Jews, not only did they not push Roosevelt to do what should be done, they voted, 90% of them, 80-90% of them voted to reelect him. They loved him and adored him. There was a saying at the time that among the Jews, there's God and then there's Roosevelt, and not necessarily in that order. That was a saying at that time, because the Jews so loved Roosevelt. When Roosevelt died in 1945, Baruch Hashem, when he finally dropped dead, that animal, the Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox wings of American Jewry all announced a day of mourning in the Jewish community. The Jewish community announced a day of mourning when Roosevelt died. They never announced any day of mourning for the 6 million Jews or for the millions that had been murdered before. They never any action like that for the 6 million Jews. But the monster that made the Holocaust possible for him, they announced a day of mourning. The crime of what was done during the Holocaust is unforgivable. You can't bring back people who were burned and gassed. Unforgivable crime. Thank God. And we're going to hopefully, God willing, I hope, Bli Neder, I hope, Bli Neder means without me making a vow here. I don't want to make a vow. But Bli Neder, I hope in upcoming programs we'll be discussing some of the things the Jewish Defense League did for Soviet Jewry. We erased a little bit of that stain on American Jewry when the JDL, led by our beloved leader, Moreinu Verabbeinu Harav Meir David Kahana Zecher Tzadik VeKadosh Livracha Hashem Yikom Damo, when the great, beloved Rabbi Kahana, the greatest Jewish leader in modern Jewish history, when this noble, magnificent, giant Rabbi Kahana formed the JDL and led the campaign, and I was honored to be the national chairman of JDL at the time. When we led this campaign to free Soviet Jews, we did what the Jews should have done during the Holocaust, and look at the different results. The Soviet Jews were saved in the end. And they told us that was hopeless too. By the way, that looked just as hopeless as they told us that you can't save the Soviet Jews. You're only going to make things worse. All the Jewish leaders said, you're only going to make things worse. What you're doing is going to backfire. What you're doing is terrible. It's counterproductive. You're crazy. You're going to turn everybody off. Look at you're doing all these crazy things to the Soviet Jewry. You're going to turn people off. You're going to cause anti-Semitism. Look what happened in the end. If you do what's right, and you're willing to sacrifice, and you love your fellow Jews, Hashem rewards those efforts. And miraculously, incredibly miraculously, Soviet Jews were saved by this organization, the JDL, came out of nowhere and took on the Soviet Empire and Soviet-American relations and international relations. It was incredible. We'll tell that story, God willing, when we have more time on a future program. That's a story that has to be told. But that's the difference between doing what was the right thing to do and not doing enough. Ben Hecht and Peter Bergson, by the way, they, with their organization during the Holocaust, they did good things and they saved a 500,000 Jews, which is proof of the fact that we could have saved a lot more. But the JDL went a lot further than them. The JDL made the issue such a front page issue with the bombings. Yes, the bombings that I did and went to prison for. And the things that we did that made it such a prominent issue. And in those days, this was a huge story. Jews bombing? Jews? Jews don't do things like that. It was such, the media couldn't resist it was such a huge story. The huge story that we made out of this, the massive international story that we made out of this, made it impossible for the Soviets to continue to hold the Jews hostage. And we paid a heavy price. I certainly paid a heavy price. I'm 62 years old. I'm still banned from going to Israel because I worked to save the Jewish people. If I had worked to destroy the Jewish people like Yasser Arafat, I would have been welcomed in Israel like Arafat was. What a sick, sick group of leaders we have in the Jewish community. But we're bringing the truth to the Jews of Israel. The one bright spot we have today is JTF's Hebrew ad campaign. And I hope also in future programs, again, Bli Neder, which means I don't like making promises because anything can happen. You know, anything can happen. I can't promise you that we're going to have future programs. Or we don't know if we're going to live today or tomorrow. We don't know. I mean, right now I'm very healthy, God, Baruch Hashem, but you always say Bli Neder when you want to promise to do something, because if you make a vow and you don't keep it, that's very serious in Judaism. That's why I'm just saying Bli Neder is a matter of practice. But I hope in the future programs to also discuss, I want to go into detail with you about what our Hebrew Aid campaigns are saying, and specifically what our, maybe show you some of the stuff that we're bringing to the Jews of Israel. Tens of thousands of Israeli Jews are seeing our ads. Tens of thousands are seeing our commercials, are seeing our ads. It's the one bright spot on the Jewish horizon today, that they're getting truth. that they never would get from anywhere else. Never. The things I'm telling you, no one would ever say. No one. And you're getting it, and well, the Israeli Jews are getting it, because of our ad campaign. Help us with our ad campaign. Help us financially, of course, with our ad campaign. The more you help us, the more people we can reach. And of course, help spread the word about JTF. Let's work together to make this a better world. If we work together to make this a better world, we can achieve great results. And we can do what we as a people are supposed to do. And that also goes for the righteous Gentiles. Because the righteous Gentiles, there's tremendous reward for righteous Gentiles helping in this noble cause. Tremendous reward for that. So let's all work together as a team. And let's work to make this a better world. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.